Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ashley and I will bring you stories along with John Russell and Katie Weaver. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, many areas of North Africa, including Tunisia and Algeria, have seen a sharp decrease in rainfall over the last 50 years. Some experts say the lack of rainfall will worsen in the future. The German research organization, the Max Planck Institute, reports that parts of North Africa and the Middle East might become unlivable in the next 100 years. Essia Gwezi is a climate and energy project officer for World Wildlife Fund North Africa, a conservation group. She told VOA, "We're seeing higher temperatures and increasing water stress in the area." She noted that rising sea levels also threaten people living near the coast. World leaders will discuss these and other issues during next month's United Nations Climate Conference in Madrid, Spain. Morocco has earned praise as a leader in fighting the effects of climate change. But experts say North Africa as a whole needs to do much more. Some countries are dealing with conflict and civil unrest. Others, such as Algeria and Libya, have economies that depend on oil. In Tunisia, fresh groundwater supplies are decreasing quickly. About two-thirds of the land is threatened by a lack of rain and loss of trees. A report by the Netherlands Foreign Ministry from 2018 says that the effects of climate change may slow Tunisia's growth in its two main industries, tourism and agriculture. Tunisian officials plan to cut the amount of carbon dioxide the country produces to 41% of levels measured in 2010 by the 2030s. Carbon dioxide gas is linked to warming of the Earth's atmosphere. However, critics say Tunisia has been slow to match words with action. In one village, Samiraskaya is trying to help change things, at least in her community. She and other area farmers began planting acacia trees to help reduce soil erosion. They also are planting moringa, a fast-growing plant valued for its nutritional and medicinal qualities. The aim was to help fight climate change while also earning money. The reality has not been so easy. She told VOA, "Everyone likes new products. The problem is selling them. It's hard to find a market." The African Union is leading an effort called the Great Green Wall Initiative. The project aims to restore damaged land across areas south of the Sahara, commonly called the Sahel. Gilles Bouetch is director of a French scientific team working with Senegalese researchers in the area. He said, "The goal is to replant trees, to return the Sahel to what it was about 60 years ago, when there was a lot more forest cover." Bouetch added that many trees die and need to be replaced, and conflict in some Sahel countries makes some areas difficult to reach. In North Africa, some national projects to fight climate change are making a difference. Tunisia will reportedly present an oases protection project at the Madrid Climate Conference. Local farmers in northern Algeria are seeking help from Mexican experts to plant prickly pear cactus. The desert plant needs little rainfall and provides nutrients and a way to make money. Algeria is also trying to renew efforts for a reforestation project that did not have good results.
Dining rooms are disappearing from restaurants in the United States as Americans increasingly use apps to order food. One example is the new Chopped Creative Salad Company restaurant, which opened last week in New York City. It is unlike any of the company's other 61 restaurants. It has no cash registers or dining tables. Atlanta-based restaurant Chick-fil-A has similar locations in two cities, Nashville, Tennessee, and Louisville, Kentucky. Customers order and prepay online. They can either go to the store for their meal or have it sent to them. Chick-fil-A is also trying something different. The company has announced plans to set up three delivery kitchens. In all three, Chick-fil-A will share space with other restaurants to prepare food for delivery only. Digital orders are a major growth area for fast food and fast casual restaurant chains. More are turning to these dark or ghost kitchens to cut costs. Wendy's, another fast food business, announced last month that it aimed to open two dark kitchens by the end of the year. Some food delivery-only operations in New York and San Francisco have failed in recent years. But in January, Travis Kalanick's Cloud Kitchens got a $400 million investment from Saudi Arabia's Sovereign Wealth Fund, Reuters reported. Kalanick is a co-founder of ride service Uber. The Wall Street Journal first reported the investment earlier this month. Cloud Kitchens, founded in 2016, builds shared food preparation areas for delivery-only restaurants to rent. Julie Atkinson is the chief marketing officer for Chopped. She says the company offered pickup and delivery orders soon after it opened 18 years ago. Today, those orders make up nearly half of its business at larger restaurants, she said. We are sensing a really huge customer need for speed, for convenience, she said. We're hopeful that this concept really raises the bar on customer convenience. I'm John Russell.
The inventor of the World Wide Web, Tim Berners-Lee, says the web has changed the world for good and improved the lives of billions. But he adds that many people still have no internet access. And access comes with very high costs, including loss of privacy, misinformation, state-sponsored attacks, and other criminal acts. This week, Berners-Lee released a contract for the web. The action plan is designed to save the web. The contract was a year-long effort by the World Wide Web Foundation, where Berners-Lee is a founding director. The contract seeks commitments from governments, companies, and citizens to make and keep information freely available.
Berners-Lee said, "This is the first time we've had a rule book in which responsibility is being shared." The contract says governments must make sure everyone can connect to the web. It also says governments need to keep all of the internet available all of the time. And it asks governments to respect and protect people's privacy and data rights. For companies, the contract says they have the responsibility to make the internet low cost enough for everyone to use it. It says companies also must respect people's privacy and data rights. And it says companies should be developing technologies that support the best in humanity and challenge the worst. Private citizens also play a part. The contract urges them to be creators and collaborators of the web. It says citizens should build strong and respectful online communities. And it says citizens should fight for the web to remain open. The contract is non-binding, however. Its partners and financial supporters include Google and Facebook. The two companies have been criticized for creating a toxic online environment with its business models.
Amnesty International recently released a report charging that Google and Facebook's business model threatens human rights. It says the company's surveillance-based business model is incompatible with the right to privacy. The report also says the business model threatens other rights, including freedom of opinion and expression, freedom of thought, and the right to equality and non-discrimination. Berners-Lee said of Facebook and Google, "Having them in the room is really important." He said, "We feel that companies and governments deserve equal seats at the table, and understanding where they're coming from is equally valuable." Other major financial supporters of the foundation include the Swedish and German International Development Agencies, the Ford Foundation, and Omidyar Network.
The contract for the web asks governments to make sure everyone can connect to the internet. But some governments have increased their control over internet access. Just this month, Iran shut down the internet and limited communications with the outside world, following huge protests over rising gasoline prices. And last month, Iraq blocked its citizens from going online in answer to a massive anti-government movement. The Keep It On Coalition reports that there were over 180 internet shutdowns across 25 countries in 2018. Most of the countries were in Asia and Africa.
In its first ever digital economy report, the United Nations warned that inequality will worsen unless the international community addresses the so-called digital divide. That is the divide between underconnected and highly connected countries. The report says the United States and China create a large majority of their wealth in the digital economy. The two countries own as much as 90% of the market value of the world's 70 largest digital companies. The rest of the world, especially countries in Africa and Latin America, are far behind the U.S. and China. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres wrote in the report's introduction, "We must work to close the digital divide, where more than half the world has limited or no access to the Internet. Inclusivity is essential to building a digital economy that delivers for all." The Contract for the Web asks users to take an active role to save the web. It suggests users strongly oppose the weaponization of the web by nation states and support companies that fight for human rights and the public good.
Berners-Lee says he will consider the contract a success when a critical mass of governments and companies have put the right laws and policies in place to create an open and empowering web for all. He added that success would mean most people communicate positively and respectfully online. I'm Katie Weaver.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In July of 1861, Union soldiers from the North and Confederate soldiers from the South fought the first major battle in the American Civil War. They clashed at Manassas, or Bull Run, Virginia, less than 50 kilometers from Washington. The Union soldiers fought fiercely, but two large Confederate forces broke the Union attack. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell about some of the other early battles of the Civil War.
Northerners had expected to win the Battle of Bull Run. They believed the Confederacy would fall if the Union won a big military victory early in the war. Now, however, there was great fear that Southern soldiers would seize Washington. The Union needed to build and train an army quickly. President Abraham Lincoln named General George McClellan to do this. McClellan was 34 years old. The young general had two important tasks. He must defend Washington from attack, and he must build an army to strike at enemy forces in Virginia. McClellan wasted no time. He put thousands of troops into position around the city, and he built 48 forts. After this rush of activity, however, little more happened for a long time. McClellan told his wife, "I shall take my own time to make an army that will be sure of success. As soon as I feel my army is well organized and well trained and strong enough, I will force the rebels to a battle." McClellan kept making excuses for why he would not move against the enemy. His excuses became a continuing source of trouble for President Lincoln. The public, the press, and politicians all demanded that McClellan do something. They wanted to win the war, and win it right away.
McClellan commanded the biggest army in the Union, the Army of the Potomac. But it was not the only army. Others were battling Confederate forces in the West. The Confederates had moved up through Tennessee into the border state of Kentucky. They built forts and other defensive positions across the southern part of the state. They also blocked as many railroads and rivers as they could. Their job was to keep Union forces from invading the South through Kentucky. One of the Union generals in the area was Ulysses Grant. Grant had served in the Army for 20 years. He had fought in America's war against Mexico and had won honors for his bravery. When that war ended, he was sent to an Army base far from his wife and children. He did not like being without them, and he did not like being an officer in peacetime. Grant began to drink too much alcohol. He began to be a problem. In 1854, he was asked to leave the army. When the Civil War started, Grant organized a group of unpaid soldiers in Illinois. With the help of a member of Congress, he was named a general. All of the other Union generals knew Ulysses Grant. Few had any faith in his abilities. They were sure he would always fail.
Grant, however, had faith in himself and his men. He believed he could force Confederate soldiers to withdraw from both Kentucky and Tennessee. Then he would be free to march directly into the Deep South, Mississippi. Two Confederate forts stood in Grant's way. They were in Tennessee, close to the Kentucky border. United States Navy gunboats captured the first, Fort Henry, on the Tennessee River. That fort was easy to attack and not well defended. The fighting was over by the time Grant and his men got there. The second, Fort Donelson, was nearby on the Cumberland River. It was stronger and defended by 20,000 soldiers. Grant surrounded the fort and let the Navy gunboats shell it. The fighting there lasted several days.
At one point, the Confederates tried to break out of the fort and escape. They opened a hole in the Union line and began to retreat. Suddenly, however, their commanding officer decided it would be wrong to retreat. He ordered them back to the fort. After that, there was no choice. The Confederates would have to surrender. The commanding officer sent a message to General Grant. What were the terms of surrender? Grant's answer was simple. No terms except unconditional and immediate surrender. The Confederates gave up Fort Donelson. Grant took 14,000 prisoners. It was the greatest Union victory since the start of the war. Ulysses Grant was a hero. Newspapers called him Unconditional Surrender Grant.
After the Union victory at Fort Donelson, Confederate forces withdrew from Tennessee. They moved farther south and began to regroup at Corinth, Mississippi. Confederate generals hoped to build one big army to stop Ulysses Grant. They would have to move fast. Grant was marching toward Corinth with 40,000 men. Another 35,000, under the command of Don Buell, were to meet him on the way. Grant arrived in the area first. He waited for Buell, 30 kilometers from Corinth, near a small country meeting hall called Shiloh Church. Confederate General Albert Sidney Johnston was waiting, too. He had more than 40,000 men, about the same as Grant, and he was expecting another 20,000. But when he learned that Grant was nearby, he decided not to wait. He would attack immediately.
Johnston did not know it, but his attack came as a surprise. Union officers to believe reports that Johnston was on the move, that his army was not strong enough to attack. Union troops did not prepare defensive positions. They had no protection when the battle began. The fighting at Shiloh was the bitterest of the war. It was not one battle, but many. Groups of men fought each other all across the wide battlefield. From a distance, they shot at each other. Close up, they cut each other with knives. The earth became red with blood. The dead and wounded soon lay everywhere. At first, the Confederates pushed Grant's army back. They had only to break through one more line, and victory would be theirs. But in the thick of the struggle, General Johnston was shot in the leg. The bullet cut through an artery. Johnston bled to death before help arrived. Any hope for a southern victory at Shiloh died with him. By the time the fighting began again the next day, General Buell had arrived to help Grant. The Confederate army retreated. The Union army let it go.
Shiloh. The word itself came to mean death and destruction. The Battle of Shiloh had brought home to the American people, both of the North and South, the horror of war. It was the first time so many men, 100,000, had fought against each other in the Western world. It was the American people's first real taste of the bloodiness of modern warfare. As one soldier who fought there said, it was too shocking, too horrible. I hope to God that I may never see such things again. The North won the Battle of Shiloh, but it paid a very high price for victory. More than 13,000 Union soldiers were killed, wounded, or missing. On the Confederate side, more than 10,000 soldiers were killed or wounded. The North celebrated the news of its victory, but joy quickly turned to anger when the public learned of the heavy losses. People blamed General Grant. They demanded that President Lincoln dismiss him. Lincoln thought of the two men who were now his top military commanders, McClellan and Grant. They were so different. McClellan organized an army and then did nothing. Grant organized an army and moved. Lincoln said of Grant, I cannot do without this man. He fights.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.
This is VOA News.